And Farrell will collect those after the meeting for us. Thank you, Farrell. And remember, even though you have a really loud and clear voice, if you want to make a comment or you want to ask a question, please go to one of the microphones so we can get that on the recording and so that people who are listening in a view-only status can hear what you're saying. Thanks.
Thank you, Pat. This brings us to item Roman numeral number 3. Adoption of the agenda for today's January 25th, 2023 Faculty Senate meeting. May I have a motion and a second to adopt the agenda? Second. Okay, Sarah Mash. Any discussion regarding the agenda? Seeing no discussion, all in favor signify by saying aye. Any oppose? Abstention? The approval of the agenda for today's meeting has passed, and we shall now move to item 4 to approve minutes of the meeting from November 16, 2023. Everyone should have the minutes in your agenda packet that Pat emailed to members. And the minutes can be seen on page 4 through 6 of your agenda packet. Gonna take like a few minutes, a minute or so, for folks who might want to review it. Well, I like silence on snowy days. Looks like not seeing anything. We will get moving. May I have a motion and a second to approve the minute? Okay. Great. Any discussion? Deletions? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed? Abstentions? Okay, the minutes are approved. Thank you, everyone. Item 5 of the agenda is public comment. But do we have any timely request for public comment?
No public comment today.
Great, thank you. So we will move now to item 6, Faculty Senate President announcement. We have a very packed agenda today, so I am going to move on to our main agenda item. But before I do that, I just want to take the opportunity to welcome everyone back to campus and also to draw your attention to a letter that has been signed and sent on behalf of Vice President for Diversity, Equity and Inclusion in support of our Asian American and Pacific Islanders regarding the two tragedies that had occurred in California, namely in Monterey Park and Half Moon Bay. And I want to ask those who so well maybe to take a minute of silence in, you know, recognition of this tragedy. Thank you. We will now move to agenda item 7, provost announcement. Provost Ingram is not able to join us today, but she did send me a couple of announcements that she asked me to convey on her behalf. And the first of this had to do with the search for Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, chaired by Vice President Clint for Student Affairs, Clint Michael. And this search is kicking off as we speak. Position is not yet available in employment system, but it will soon be listed. The provost asked me not only to announce it, but also to urge interested faculty who would be interested in considering this position. So please give it a thought if you are. Secondly, as many of you know, Dean Lori Elish Piper will be transitioning to the position of interim Executive Vice President and Provost at the end of June. The search for acting dean in the College of Education, which is led by Dr. Paul Castle, is also being kicking off in preparation for this transition. So Provost Ingram wanted to make sure that the Senate is informed about this development. Information on both searches, including committee members, is available on Executive Vice President and Provost website under About and Searches. So if any of you interested in gaining more information about this, you can find that on the website. And finally, she also wanted me to bring to the attention of this body the discussion, recent discussion pertaining to AI, artificial intelligence, particularly revolving around the issue of ChatGPT. She wants you to know that the academic leadership had spirited discussion over this issue, and she expects that colleges and our unit are also carrying on this discussion as well, because this is something that really concerns, you know, the academic culture, ACES, so many dimensions. ACES is just one. I mean, this is a tool that, you know, can be used and asked to generate an essay. And this, you know, how do we as faculty ascertain students' creative work versus things that is being done on behalf of, you know, student through this system? So that's something that is taking place. The Center for Instructional Technology created a website related to this issue. So there are, you know, Q&A kind of informational website dedicated to this topic. So if you are interested, you could also find that information there. With that, we will move to item 8, items for Faculty Senate consideration. And we have the 3 presentations line up to update this body today. The first of this is going to be presented by my colleague Peter Chemontowski and Liz Gers, pertaining to State University Retirement System Member Advisory Committee, also known as CERMAC. So
that here? Yeah, I think we're on. Sure. Yep, there you go. Be that one right there.
All right. Good afternoon, how are you? All right, so me and Liz today are going to talk about the State University's Retirement System Member Advisory Committee. I am the NIU academic representative and Liz is the non-academic representative. And so we want to give you a little information. So really, a little brief information is I'm going to give you an idea about what CIRMAC is, because I'm probably assuming some people don't know what CIRMAC is and what the history of them. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about some of the activity that they actually do. And then from there, we're going to get into what we really wanted to kind of present today was that there may be a possible dissolution or dissolving of the CIRMAC committee. And CIRS has brought this and had a vote on it. And so Liz is going to present some information on that and then talk about more about what CIRS is planning for the future if CIRMAC committee is actually dissolved, basically. So just a little about the history. Basically, like I said, the Employees Advisory Committee was created in 1941, and it is originally made by the University of Illinois president, and it was basically made for specific recommendations from CIRS to the Board of Trustees. Through the years, it has changed a little bit. In 1953, the EAC was expanded to include representatives of all institutions covered by CIRS. And so we have, like, for example, two representatives for our university, and every other university has the same thing. And we can come to, and it's basically as listed as the CIRMAC committee. In 1967, the EAC was expanded to include a number of faculty and non-academic. So like I said, I'm the academic faculty and Liz represents a non-academic. And in 1971, the EAC was expanded to include a retiree representative from the state and universities, Annuity Association, which is an association that's set up to basically advocate on behalf of faculty and staff of universities and colleges, community colleges also, both retired and current, even spouses and survivors of people who participate in the beneficiary program for the university retirement system. And then 1972, EAC was finally changed to CIRSMAC. And that's what it's been. And we have a committee that's run through Faculty Senate. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So activity of CIRSMAC from 2008-2012, there was 11 resolutions that CIRSMAC adopted by the CIRMAC committee. If you look at them, they were mainly dealt with something like timely contributions, the need to protect health care insurance benefits, the need for CIRS staff, and also to amend Illinois' constitution for graduated income tax. Not all these resolutions were recommended to CIRS, and CIRMAC does not participate in the legislative or lobbying, but CIRMAC is basically works to present these concerns and working the resolutions with CIRS, and then CIRS can basically works through the legislative board to make the adoptions or decisions. Now, from 2012 to 22, there's been no resolutions that a CIRMAC has been part of. Only activity has been electing officers and revisiting bylaws. So in 14, CIRMAC stopped being an advisory group to the CIRS Board of Trustees. So with that, CIRS basically voted to sever the relationship with the Open Meeting Act and fiduciary concerns, and CIRMAC, as advised by the bylaws, can share feedback. So CIRMAC's been basically kind of like a reporting between CIRS and CIRMAC. And basically from the CIRMAC committee, then we can provide information to you of what's going on in these meetings. And so as of right now that I've been on CIRMAC, we meet once a semester. It's a Teams meeting. We would get together and all the basically non-academic and academic would all join in with some of the executive board from CIRS. And they would present things to us about legislative, financial things, future upcomings and stuff like that. And then we can actually work with them and then supply the information to the individuals at the universities that we represent. Now, with that, one of the things that's come up is that the possible dissolution of meeting, getting rid of the CIRMAC committee. So Liz will talk.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Yes, I just wanted to share a little information on this possibility of the dissolution of the committee. A year ago in the spring, the CIRS executive director did contact the CIRSMAC executive committee, of which I'm a member, and they really expressed their need to kind of release their involvement from CSRSMAC. So CSRSMAC is not an entity of CSRS. It's as was mentioned, a group of individuals from each of the different universities and community colleges. So CSRS had said, you know, they are no longer able to host the meetings. They can't provide information on their website. Like, they really needed to kind of make a separation from the CSRSMAC committee, because CSRSMAC isn't necessarily an entity of CSRS. And so that information was shared with the executive committee. And then last summer, the executive committee had several conversations just around the history of CSRSMAC, what CSRSMAC has done, and a lot around the inactivity inactivity from this committee, in the past 10 years. And so we looked at the original intent of the committee. We looked at the bylaws, we looked at past meeting notes and agenda items, and just had kind of realized that it's possible that CSRSMAC has kind of seen its vision. And a lot of what has happened with CSRSMAC has really turned into information sharing. So as was mentioned, what has really become of these meetings is the CSRS Executive Committee is presenting information on benefits, legislative, and investment updates in turn that we can share with each of our universities and community colleges. And so there hasn't been a lot of activity amongst that group, but more information sharing. And so in the fall meeting, so just this past semester, the executive committee did bring up the possibility of dissolving the CSRSMAC committee to the entire group of membership. And there was some lively discussion about it. I think there was a couple of retired faculty from the University of Illinois that really did express some concern, feeling that the CSRSMAC was more of a watchdog group, and they felt, you know, concerns if the watchdog group disappeared. There was a lot of discussion around the Annuitants Association. So we're obviously here today to talk about CSRSMAC, but do want to mention the Annuitants Association, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But the CSRSMAC didn't really play a role in the legislative or lobbying process. And over time, there's been a lot of roles at the universities that have developed. Most universities have at least a couple people in the position of government relations at the state and federal level. We have benefit groups, we have university president groups. So any topic that is of interest to the CSRSMAC committee definitely has a way to be expressed and communicated through the different universities and community colleges, and those groups can pull together, you know, as necessary. But we weren't really finding that that activity was necessarily coming directly from the CSRSMAC. So CSRSMAC, I think, has kind of turned into be more information sharing. And so what we anticipate happening is in the spring meeting, which will likely take place in March or April, that the CSRSMAC constituent groups will be asked to vote on the dissolution of CSRSMAC. So we wanted to make sure that this was information that was shared with all of you in advance of that meeting. Through this process, the CSRS has committed to holding two stakeholder meetings. So we definitely wanted to make sure that this information was shared. In the fall, they held this meeting in November, and they do record the session, and the session is available on the CSRS website. They did send like formal announcements on the session to several of the union groups in the state, and then also to SUA and the CSRSMAC membership. But it's important that everyone is aware, and we will be working to get this more publicized, that any member of the CSRS can attend this session. And so the one that's coming in the spring is going to be held April 13th from 1 to 2 o'clock. It's a virtual session. Registration is required on the CSRS website, but anybody is welcome to attend. So for anybody who's looking for that information directly from the CSRS, they're going to be covering topics like benefits and investment and a legislative update. So that information will be available to employees at the time, and then they can also go back and view that if they're unable to make that meeting. Questions can be asked in advance, questions can be asked during the session, and CSRS has also made it very clear that anybody can contact CSRS at any time, you know, to seek that information or to ask questions. So like I said, this wasn't necessarily a presentation on the Annuitants Association, but we definitely want to comment on the role that the Annuitants Association plays. They do take an active role in the legislative and lobbying process. They do definitely advocate on behalf of all retirees and active employees in the state to preserve those pension benefits through the State University's retirement system. So this is definitely a way and a group that is still actively involved in any legislative activity that would have an impact to the CERS benefits. And that is all the information we had. We can take questions now, but also wanted to list our contact information should you have any, you know, follow-up questions after this. Sure.
David Valentine from Psychology. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the CERS board is accountable to CERS members. What is the mechanism? One mechanism I imagine is that CERS board might be appointed by the governor and the governor is elected, right, by the people. But are there any other mechanisms by which the CERS board is accountable to the CERS member?
I don't know that I have a good answer other than what you've mentioned. I don't really, I'd have to follow up and give you a, you know, to get back to you on a response to that question. I don't think that they're necessarily accountable to the CERS MAC committee. They did make that decision and vote on that change that the CERS MAC doesn't have a direct connection to the CERS board. They work through the executive director of CERS. So that isn't something that I would see changing, you know, as a result of this committee. But I understand your question and would have to get back to you with a more in-depth answer.
That there might be a watchdog function that some people were worried about losing, but what would be the route by which the CERS MAC could hold the CERS board accountable, other than I suppose they could just you know, rally the troops in the institution. They could pass information back to the institution and then CERS members could make a fuss or express their discontent. Is there any other mechanism by which the CERS MAC increase the accountability of the CERS board?
So I would say, you know, any activity that takes place doesn't have to be worked through the CERS MAC. So, you know, I mentioned that there are the different benefit groups. So we have the different universities have the benefit group where all the benefit managers are connected. Similarly, we have a group with the payroll managers, the government relations at each of the universities works closely together. So I feel that, you know, not only the CERS MAC, but there's also these other groups amongst the state that connects the universities together. So, for example, new legislation comes up, our government relations is actively working with those of us at the university, with the other university government relations, pulling in university presidents as needed. So I feel like there are other groups that are actively working on this outside of just the CERS MAC, where they would be rallying, I guess, you know, the troops, so to speak, if there was anything that needed to take place. The other thing is definitely the Annuitants Association is an active group that is involved in the legislative and lobbying process. So they would be another group that would be working if there's any sort of legislation, you know, that would be impacting the benefits of CERS members or retirees.
And make a plug for the Annuitants Association. I'm on the membership committee, so probably my job. So if you're a member of NIU Annuitants Association, you're automatically a member of the State University Annuitant Association, and those dues, which are only about $3 a month, they contribute to some of those lobbying activities. So as current employees, we really do have a benefit from SUAA. So I would just recommend looking into joining the organization.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Holly.
Dallas.
Hi, Dallas Douglas, Student Government Association. I did just check the website in relation to David's question about the membership. So not all members of their board of trustees are appointed by the governor. Six of them are elected by members. So just food for thought. But then also my question more specifically was, do you anticipate the dissolution of this committee being either negatively or positively impactful to faculty and staff at NIU? And if so, to what degree?
I mean, I've been on the committee for 2 years. I don't see, I mean, what they, I guess they found is a lot of the same information that was being given to CIRMAC is available through the meetings that everyone could attend. And so a lot of people were getting the information directly from the CIRMAC representatives while there were still, you could go log on and view the meetings yourself, the same meetings that we did with CIRMAC. I mean, from what I've taken from being on the committee is that the CIRMAC was still more of passing information along that can actually be gained from going to their website. And so CIRS has actually stated that through the meetings now, which are open to everyone, as long as you register for the meeting, you can go to it and you would get the same benefit of the information that would come to us as the CIRMAC representative. So I don't think so. I mean, I don't know exactly, but I mean, that's the whole belief, I guess, of CIRS is that all the same information, that nothing's being delegated or changed. I mean.
Dr. Montana, can I ask a second question? So do the two of you intend to vote in favor of the dissolution as of now, given the information that you have?
Well, I mean, the next meeting is when we're really, so this was brought to our attention, the meeting in November. So we're supposed to get more shared information. So at the meeting in November, they brought this up that this is coming. And so the spring meeting, we are supposed to be given information for all the representatives and CIRMAC to go and look at to see whether or not we want to. I haven't been shared information yet, so I don't know. But we brought this up because what happened was someone wrote a letter to an editor that was concerned about this. Someone that was a retired member. And that's what kind of started this, where we wanted to present the information to you ahead of time before we were given information. So I don't know yet until we get the information. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So in the interest of time, we'll take two more questions and then, yeah, so you go ahead.
Cynthia Campbell, Department of Educational Technology, Research and Assessment. And actually, I was going to ask about unintended consequence. Thank you for doing that. I was going to piggyback up on that. And I'm not that familiar with the CIRS MAC, but I know from the presentation about the history of it, at one time there was a need for that. And I'm just wondering, if such a need arises again, is there some sort of way, some sort of clause where it could be, again, sort of more involved with the CIRS system? Once it's decoupled, is there any mechanisms for that to happen and something to think about just as a safety net?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. So we obviously haven't gotten as far as the dissolution. I think one thing that I did mention that is important is that what has evolved over time is a lot of the connections that we have with the other CIRS employers. And so I do feel confident that if there was any activity that all of these groups would be able to get connected much more quickly than they possibly could 80 years ago when the committee was initially, you know, in its inception. So I think that's something that we can bring up in conversation in this next meeting with the ability, you know, to pull together. But I think that just is happening much more naturally as events today are occurring. Like we work very closely with other universities through the COVID pandemic and with new legislation that's coming, with anything that our government relations is working on, we're also working closely with the other universities, community colleges. So I think there are a lot of connections within this group and in the universities and community colleges in general, but that's something that we definitely can share with, should it proceed with the dissolution, with how this, you know, groups can get connected on an as needed basis.
Any other question? Okay, if not, Pete, this contact information are still there.
Yep.
So feel free to reach out to both of them or either of them, and any additional question, I'm sure they would be happy to respond to your questions.
Yep, so thank you for your time today.
Thanks.
So our next agenda item is item 8B. I just mentioned AI and chat GTP. We don't always have to wait until technology kind of impose on us to scramble to look for solutions. So we're happy to have Fred Williams, who is Senior Director of Information Technology Infrastructure, who is here to share and update us on the work related to his division. So the floor is all yours.
Hi, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. I think this is the first time I've been to the Faculty Senate, and it's nice to meet some of you. I had a presentation today that wanted to cover it's really two different topics. One is why we really need information security today, and then some of the most common misconceptions about information security. And why do we need it today? Well, there's kind of a general loose understanding of there's bad guys out there, there's hackers, and there's all this bad stuff that happens in cyberspace. But what you may not realize is that cybercrime is now the third largest economy in the world. Cyber hackers have striated into very specific niches. They have created their own economy. They have people that provide sites and services to perpetrate cyber crimes. There's people that specialize in each aspect of a cyber crime, all the way from the beginning, which are called initial access brokers, down to the very end where they launder the money. So it's a big threat today. And in fact, if you're not familiar with what ransomware is a very particular type of cybercrime. There's many different types of cybercrime, but ransomware is likely our number one threat today. And so in 2021, there was a cybersecurity report that the average total cost for rectifying a ransomware attack only in the education sector, the corporate and financial and others, they have different metrics, but for education, the average cost was $2.73 million per incident. Okay. These things happen, and they happen close to home. NIU has seen a number of attempts of ransomware attacks as recently as last year. And we see Sycamore School District had an attack. DeKalb County had an attack. One of our vendors that we use had an attack right as we began to onboard them. And Lincoln College actually closed due to a ransomware attack. It became too expensive for them, and they had to close their doors. Ransomware is not the only thing that we're concerned with. These are highlighted in red, the top threats that NIU faces today. And something you may not be aware of is the number of these threats work in concert together. So they're just not one-offs, but a phishing attack could lead to a malware, which could lead to ransomware. So there's a chain of events that happen here that is very complicated and something we need to be on guard for. So what is NIU doing? What is information security NIU doing about this? Well, primarily, the number one attack vector that we see today is from phishing. Most malware, ransomware, identity theft, credit card theft, Bitcoin theft, cybercurrency theft, all starts with phishing. So we have, for the last 4 or 5 years, really embarked on a strong campaign to help educate our faculty and staff against the dangers and how to identify phishing. And we can see here in the metrics, it's working. Earlier in 2021, we had a phishing, I'm gonna call it a failure rate, or it's fish prone is what's called, if somebody's susceptible to seeing a fish and then unfortunately acting on it, clicking a link or giving information or engaging with the bad actor, was up to about 10%. And just over the last couple of years, we've got that down to 5% now. So this has shown to be really effective for us. We have been doing some monthly campaigns with self-phishing. And what we've seen now, because our faculty and staff have become more capable of spotting these malicious fish and not responding or reporting them to us. Unfortunately, the bad actors have turned more towards our students. And so we're seeing more students being targeted with phishing. And what we're doing now is we're putting together training specifically geared for our student body. And I'm hoping maybe with some contact here today or somebody else, I'd be able to engage in a way to launch that in a meaningful way for our students to help also have them be aware of the threats faced to them. The bad guys are after their student financial aid. They're after any student information. And what they can do is they can take a compromised student account, turn around and leverage that and turn that back against the university organization in general to then accelerate some of these other threats. Just for some numbers, NIU transacts over 6.5 million emails per month. And of those, we positively identify in our office 150,000 malicious phishing emails. That's over one phishing email per person, faculty, staff, and student per week at NIU. And we're not even special. All right, so why else do we need information security? Well, it's not just about the cyber threats. There are a lot of good people that need additional help with regulations. And this is just a subset of the regulations and a breakdown of kind of the areas that they cover that are important to NIU. Compliance with these are very important for the university, research, privacy, federal, there's more in here than we can really cover, but it is important that information security to know is not just about protecting from bad guys. It's also about trying to do the right thing by a lot of these regulations. And if you've listened to the news, there's been a significant investment in tightening cybersecurity regulations and privacy regulations and all of that. And all of that needs to happen at NIU to stay compliant so that we can continue to function. All right, so number one misconception about information security is that information security and cybersecurity are the same thing. I could have added a couple more in here. Privacy typically gets commingled with these terms. So does compliance. It gets commingled with these terms. But really, breakdown it looks like this. Information security is the set of practices, policies, controls that affect data no matter where it exists. So that's in the physical realm, it's in the cyber realm, it's on this table, it's back at your home, it's in your office, it's wherever you take it and wherever you access it from, whatever device is on it. It spreads across the whole gamut of how data is used, consumed, accessed, viewed. Cybersecurity really is the focus on the digital, electrical, devices, access, network, systems. So they're a little bit separate. And the focus, though, is similar. Information security is really about protecting three things that we're going to get into in just a little bit. And that is confidentiality, availability, and integrity. So some things in the physical realm that's a threat to data is not necessarily a threat in the digital realm is things like fire. If you have paper files and it's in an office that catches fire, you may not have a backup of those, right? That could be a real risk. Okay. Oh, sorry. I should have went to this one. So when I talked about the scope of where everything is, it's not just information security or cybersecurity. It's really information security and cybersecurity. They really have to work together because so much of what we do with data and information is interconnected by how we use it through electronic communications. And so on here we have shared information with business partners. Our business partners are part of the information security process. Everything in our organization in green, everything that's at home when you work remote or work anywhere. And then lastly, if you're out at a cafe or you travel or whatever, NIU is a tremendously global organization. The last time I looked, NIU visited over 80 countries a year. And we've got students from all over. So the information security and cybersecurity risks span all of that. It spans globally. Misconception number two, Information security is only IT's problem. Or it's only my problem, maybe. I know a lot of people like to think that, but it's not really. It's important that we all know that in order to protect the information, it's everywhere it's at, and it involves everybody that touches it and uses it. So when you think about information security, and you think about who participates in information security practices, it's all of us. All of us are involved in the process one way or another, how we handle it on our own system, how we protect our system, what we do with paper documents. Do we shred them? Do we just leave them open? All of that stuff. Also, there's a really fascinating, I really like this. It's a great paradigm for information security that breaks it down to something, I think, somewhat simple. A lot of times people think about cybersecurity, information security. It's all about the technology. It's all about things you've seen in hacker movies. But really, it breaks down to three key parts. It's our people, it's our process, and then it's our technology. And it's where those three intersect that we really have success. All right, and then the last misconception I found about information security is that it's the CISO's job, or it's information security's job, or it's IT's job to prevent all the bad things. We can't prevent people from doing bad things as much as we can prevent the sun from setting tonight. What we can do, and what we have done, is we always try to implement best practices, policies, multiple layers of business processes and controls so that we minimize the potential for an attack to be successful, and we minimize the potential of the impact if there's anything that gets through some one or two layers. Okay. This is an aspirational slide where we're really going. As I figured, I want to talk about where we're going. Information security cannot function in a vacuum. Information security is moving towards a risk-based management framework, and that risk discussion has to be part of all sorts of business operations and business discussions. And so this is really more of an inspirational slide of where I'd like to see the information security program evolve to in terms of risk-informed information security. Okay, thank you very much. If there's any time for questions, I'll open it to questions.
Thank you very, very much. We will take a couple of questions.
I have a question. I just wanted to say I really appreciate the banner that says this is external. Think before you click, because it really makes me think before I click.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Okay, well, if there are no other questions, thank you for having me, and I hope I shared some information that was useful to you. Thank you.
Okay, we will move to item 8C, which is going to be presentation on Baccalaureate Council by Commander Ferguson, Department of Management, and Baccalaureate Council Assistant Chair, and Alicia Shetman, Rector for Center for Nonprofit and NGO Study, and Assistant Chair for the General Education Committee. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Amanda Ferguson. I'm an Associate Professor in the Management Department and currently co-chair of the Baccalaureate Council. So thank you for having us, and Alicia Shetman is going to be speaking about the General Education Committee. We appreciate the opportunity to tell you a little bit more about the work that we do on these important committees and to answer any questions that you might have. So I thought what we would do is talk about who is on the committee and what representation that we have, some of the duties of the committee, and where you can find out more information. Sorry, do I have a clicker or do I? Oh, thank you. I'm sorry about that. First, in terms of we'll go through the membership composition and then also the duties and what we do in terms of undergraduate education. it broadly has representation from a lot of different stakeholders at NIU on this council. So we have faculty members, we have students, and we have administrators and staff members that are all very important members of this committee. So it's a large committee, but it's an important committee for the work that is done. So in terms of faculty representation, we have faculty from each undergraduate degree granting college, plus the university libraries. And then we sometimes that number of faculty per college depends on the number of undergraduate programs, credit hours, and things like that. So currently, we have 16 faculty representing colleges, some with more, some with less. So, for example, we have two from the College of Business, and there are more for College of Liberal Arts and Sciences due to that nature of the types of programs and the number of students and credit hours that there are. And we also have one representing university libraries. Each faculty term is 3 years, and each year, every year a co-chair is selected. So this year I was selected to be the assistant chair or the faculty chair, along with Omar Grayab, who is the chair of the committee. In terms of students, we strive to have one student, undergraduate student from each college selected by the student advisory committee of the college. If the student advisory committee doesn't recommend a student or doesn't identify a student, then the baccalaureate council members will recommend a student to have broad representation. We also want one student to be a minority or non-traditional student. And what's important about the student representation on the committee, I think, is that they are full voting members, and they are really important to the work that we do because they have a voice about how undergraduate curriculum changes or policies or programs. They have excellent questions and points about the student perspective on some of those proposed changes that we can take into account, and then they can also be full voting members whenever we look at those types of changes. Finally, we have administration representation. So the current chair of the committee is the vice provost for undergraduate education, Omar. He votes to break ties, but otherwise he's ex officio. We have a member who is a voting member from the advising unit. And we also have other non-voting members that are crucial to the work of the committee in terms of their perspectives based on their specific units. For example, director of admissions, we have educational licensure represented, and people from registration and records who attend, and these people are particularly helpful in providing perspective on specific questions that arise in the committee in terms of curricular changes that might be proposed or how those might be implemented, things like that. And so they serve an important function on the committee. Okay, so what do we do? Anything that has to do with undergraduate curriculum policy, academic standards, that sort of thing will come to the Baccalaureate Council. So if there are new programs of undergraduate study, if there are proposed changes to academic standards or admission or retention requirements, all of those things will come through the Baccalaureate Council. They often initiate at lower levels, but not always. So just an overview of the curricular approval procedure. Typically, not always, but typically changes to curriculum in terms of courses, programs, certificates, things like that will happen at the department level and be approved by the department curriculum committee. That will then go to the college curriculum committee and will be approved there. Then it will come to the catalog editor, and the catalog editor organizes that information and puts it through to an agenda for the Baccalaureate Council, or the GEC, which Alicia will talk about in a minute. And then the Baccalaureate Council members, first the executive committee of the Baccalaureate Council and the catalog editor will go through the proposed agenda and changes and prepare the agenda materials for the council. And then the entire council gets visibility to that agenda and those materials and goes through that. What I thought would be helpful to point out here is a couple of different aspects of philosophy for the Baccalaureate Council. So the Baccalaureate Council is not necessarily in the business of questioning what individual departments and colleges want to do for students. So we would not, for example, on the council, if a new course is proposed, we would not say, "Are you sure that your students really need that course?" Right? We assume that the departments and colleges are the experts in what their students need. However, we do have some certain processes that ensure that we're not duplicating resources or that we are making sure that student impact or student needs are being taken into account from a bigger picture point of view. So for example, if a department wants to propose a new course, we ask that they look into duplication to make sure that another unit on campus doesn't already offer a similar course so that we wouldn't be duplicating resources. And or if a new course or a proposed change to a course suddenly requires students to meet some sort of standards that they hadn't had to meet before, like suddenly they need to have a C or better in a prerequisite course in order to enroll for this course, we want to make sure that they have gone through due diligence to explain the rationale for that change in standards so that we're making sure that it's a comprehensive and it's well thought through. So that's more of our role, is to make sure to provide that bigger picture view for cross-college impact and for impact on standards. The other philosophy that is relatively recent in the last couple of years is that back in the day when we only had a paper catalog, we had to adhere to strict deadlines and still do and for many things in terms of changes to programs or majors or minors or courses and things like that, because some of these changes are quite big, right? For example, if a new minor is proposed, it's not just up to the department committee, the college, the baccalaureate council, it also has to go beyond us to other bodies, and it takes some time. So there are deadlines in place to make sure that all of those proposed changes can go through those different bodies or different committees. But in the age where we have an online catalog, there are other changes that are relatively minor. Say a department wants to change the description of their course to make it more in line with how it's currently being taught, or there's an update in the field, and so they're going to be delivering content that's more updated with current practice, right? This is a minor change and doesn't necessarily have to go through all of these different committees. And so for that reason, we have instituted an expedited process for curricular items that are more minor in nature that don't have cross-college impact, and for which the departments can and colleges can approve those, and those can be put into place in the online catalog more quickly. So that's a recent change in the last couple of years that has hopefully enabled the departments and colleges to be more flexible and adaptive and quick with their changes, whereas some changes do take some more time and some more oversight. If you are interested in the meetings and records, we meet is it the first Thursday of every month? I'm sorry, I'm blanking. Carol, first Thursday of every month at 12:30. And the minutes are distributed to the Executive President of Faculty Senate, Executive President, Vice President and Provost, Deans of the degree granting colleges for undergraduate degrees, and the Dean of University Libraries. So you would have visibility to those minutes. I'm going to turn it over to Alicia next, and then I'll stick around to answer questions.
Thank you, Amanda. So I was sitting on the Baccalaureate Council. I'm a representative from the Department of Public Administration, and now I'm the chair of the General Education Committee. So it's a standing committee of the BC. We have faculty representation who are voting, a student representative who is also voting, and some ex officio members. So in terms of the GEC, we have three members that are chosen by the faculty of the BC, which that's how I ended up on the GEC. One faculty representative appointed by the curriculum committee, three faculty representatives from CLAS, and then you'll see from humanities, social sciences, and other. And the terms are staggered, renewable for 3-year terms. In terms of the student representation, we have three students that are nominated by the SAC, as Amanda had said, and they also serve 1-year renewable terms. On the administration, we have an advising representative, again, really important to the GEC, the vice provost, and then one designee of the provost from the Office of Institutional Effectiveness. So how we conduct our business, very similar to the BC. Primarily, we monitor and evaluate university general education, the program. We recommend policies and procedures, make suggestions sometimes to colleges and departments to improve general education. And then we also approve addition or removal of courses from the general education. We oversee improvement and design and some of the things that we're doing now, I'll talk about that, and report that work back to the BC. So anything we do in the GEC goes back to the BC, they see it and then they approve it. So that's the advisory role that we play. And we meet the third Thursday of the month. So in terms of the shared governance, and this is, we can probably tag team this a little bit because this isn't just the GEC, but students, faculty, staff, administration, all participate in the curricular process. Once approved by College Curriculum Committee, those expedited items that Amanda mentioned does come before the BC or the GEC, depending on if it has a GEC component, a general education component, and then it moves on. So one of the charts that Carol put together for us is so that you can see when you want to create or amend or add to what the process is. And as Amanda said, it does start at the department and then moves on from there, depending on how much new is coming before us. It can go all the way up to IBHE if you're proposing a brand new degree program. So that's the guide that we use. You'll see individual courses, often that's just a department or college, if you're just making small amendments. As you add a certificate or a minor, you can see that it kind of goes up from there. So one of the things that we've been working on for the last year in the GEC, and probably if you're a chair, you'll see this, but certainly if you're faculty, you'll be discussing it. Our general education is really core to NIU and one of the things we're very proud of, but we have not done a good job in terms of assessing the general education courses as a whole and against our baccalaureate learning outcomes. So over the last year, the GEC and then going to the BC has identified all the general education courses. If you've been around here for a little while, 10 plus years, there was a time where everyone was creating general education courses and now we have a lot of them. And then resources and student enrollment started to shrink and all of a sudden we have the reverse happening, right? So in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, where the bulk of the general education courses live, we have a lot of general education courses that are on the books, but maybe not as many that are taught. So that was our first kind of look, how many are actually taught, and then how many align with the knowledge domains that we have in general education. So that was the work that we did last year to identify those knowledge domains, go through and identify which student learning outcomes. So we, in the Center for Nonprofit NGO Studies, we have one general education course. It was submitted before I became director, and it was kind of like a checkbox. Yeah, we do critical thinking. Yeah, we do culture and society. Thank you. And it was approved as a general education course. But we've never actually assessed to what extent that course delivers on those student learning outcomes. So in the first part, which we did last year, is identifying the knowledge domains. We're going to ask the chairs between next couple of weeks and the middle of March to say, yes, we still want to be in that knowledge domain. Here's the student learning outcomes we're committed to assessing. You're not going to assess it yet. We need an assessment plan for that. We have student learning outcome rubrics that are online and probably need some retweaking, but you can go look at them. They're there. And so that assessment piece will be next year. This year is just, yes, we still want it to be a general education. Yes, it still fits or does not fit into that knowledge domain. So we'll be gathering that information between now and March. And we're happy to take questions. You have our contact information. Thank you.
Felicia Bohannon, SPSS Council. How many students are on the BC?
I believe now, currently, we have two. Is that correct, Carol? There are four. Okay. We would like to have up to seven. It's sometimes hard for us to recruit.
And I bring up that question because you indicated that you must have one minority student, quote unquote, and then one non-traditional student. And those are very different populations. So I just want to bring that up as a concern.
Thank you. That's an excellent point. I believe, thank you for raising that. I believe the language is that one student should be a minority student or a non-traditional student, but you're right. They could be very different students and perhaps
we might want to reconsider.
We might want to reconsider. Yes.
And then the other thing I noted that you mentioned that There was representation from educational services and programs as recommended by the provost. ESP doesn't exist. Are you referring specific, are you talking about CHAS? Because educational services and programs doesn't exist.
That's interesting. So we do have a CHAS person on the committee who represents the CHAS.
Okay,
Deacon.
So that's CHAS in that.
So that should be changed, I guess, in terms of our listing on our PowerPoint, not necessarily. Is it listed that way in bylaws, Carol? So we should make that amendment to the bylaws.
Yeah, that's been more than 10 years ago.
Thank you for pointing that.
I was just wondering.
Okay. It's a great question. We do have that representation. It's just not accurate right there.
Thank,
thank you. The bylaws are there for a long time, and then you go back and look at them and you go, wait, that needs to change. So thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jason Axt. I teach journalism and PR. Thanks for the presentation. I've submitted what would be a minor correction to a course description. Minor but important, because the way it's described makes it seem really outdated. So I revised it and it went through the process about a year and a half ago or so. And no one ever seems to know where that's at. Is there some way to like audit the process to find out, did it happen? Is it going to happen? You get the idea.
Catalog editor will answer that.
Hi, I'm Carol McFarlane McKee. I'm the catalog editor and curriculum coordinator. And once all the changes are put in, I work with the college curriculum administrators and send them the list of changes for them to also verify that they are in the catalog as anticipated. And registration and records also goes through and looks at everything, because they have to take the same stuff that goes into the catalog and put it into MyNIU so students can take the courses. They are not connected systems. So if something is missing, please let me know and I can go back and try and track it down. We've had a couple of those that happen when we're getting, like we had one agenda in December that was, 165 pages. Things can get lost. We do our best to try and track everything, and I have a tracking system, but it's manual tracking system in a spreadsheet. But that's how we're tracking them and trying to make sure everything gets in. So I'm sorry that you had something that needs to be in. If it's an expedited change, we can still get it in for the 23-24 catalog. The deadline technically is January 31st for those, but if it's not something that's going to have a negative impact for students, such as adding a PRQ with a grade requirement, then those are easier to make. That answer your question? Thank you.
Next question. Oh, seeing no question, please join me in thanking Amanda.
Thank you. Thank you.
Alicia.
I also want to mention that the minute that Amanda mentioned, we can always access that through the informational items. So our next agenda item is item 9, and we have only one item, which is the Bob Lane Faculty Advocacy Award for call for nominations. And we have Lori Hartentoff, Faculty Senate Rules, Government and Election Liaison, who is going to present on this item and walk us through that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call your attention to page 7 of the agenda packet, and there it lists the past recipients and the information about this award. The annual award recognizes an NIU faculty member for special service to the NIU faculty. Nominees do not need to be members of the Faculty Senate, and we encourage you to submit a written letter of nominations identifying reasons why your nominee should receive this award to the Office of Faculty Senate no later than noon on Wednesday, February 15th. Letters can be delivered hard copy or sent via email to Pat Erickson. and we will, the letters will be included in the February 22nd meeting agenda packet, and the Faculty Senate will vote on the recipients, and they will be honored at the March 29th meeting. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any question for Lori? Great, so we will move to our next agenda item 10, which is business. We have two agenda items here. 10A is a proposed amendment for a first reading to Faculty Senate bylaws, Article 4.6.3.1. And I have the pleasure now to invite Andrea Redisano, Assistant Vice Provost, University Honors Program, to introduce and present this amendment.
Hi, everybody. Nice to see you this afternoon. I guess I don't have. I'll just let you know the genesis of this very quickly, and also the vote from Honors Committee. So, as you're probably aware, the University Honors Program participates in shared governance through the University Honors Committee, which then reports into the Baccalaureate Council. So, you know, it serves as a sort of semi-curricular committee and certainly votes on all policy changes. So this was the first bylaw change, I think, in a long time, because I've been with the program for 4 years and I have had to be taught by Carol and others how bylaw changes happen. I'll think again before doing that. But the idea is that, so we also have happily, we have student representation on Honors Committee. We have faculty representation and we have student representation. We also have ex officio, but only faculty and students vote. We have faculty representation from across colleges, much like what was described by Alicia and Amanda for their committees. The students, we have 5 students. So the change that we're wanting, the change that you see before you, is that rather than have all 5 students elected by the general honors population, we would like for that to be 4, and then the 5th student to be appointed from somebody, but, well, to be, I think, ideally the lead honors fellow. We have a population of honors leaders. They act as peer advisors and mentors. They have really, really good, strong program knowledge. So it would be the same amount of student representation, except that there would be a link between the student leadership population in the program and the Honors Committee, which there wasn't before. And I think the main reason for this, honestly, and I think the rationale is up there, is just to strengthen the student voice on the committee and to make sure that students sort of feel empowered. Often, it's been noted by various faculty on the University Honors Committee that, you know, students stay quiet. They don't necessarily participate a great deal, that they could be helped by having one of among them who sort of goes, well, no, I actually just, you know, saw a student the other day who couldn't complete that requirement for these reasons, you know, and speak really confidently about student policies. So that's the basic point and rationale. Happy to take questions.
And then please join me in thanking. So we move to agenda item 10B. And this is a proposed amendment to Faculty Senate bylaws, Article 1, membership of the Faculty Senate. This amendment is proposed in order to restore language that was inadvertently removed during the 2019 and 2020 reimagining of shared governance. This proposed language restores the definition of tenure track faculty who are eligible to elect and to be elected to serve on Faculty Senate, excluding those faculty serving in selected administrative roles from eligibility. The proposed language also requires, now also restores alignment with NIU Constitution Article 7.3, which describe the right of the faculty to organize the Faculty Senate. So the information about this can be found on page 9 through 10. And there is questions. We'll take your questions. Thank you. Thank you. Seeing no comment or question, we will move on to agenda item 11, report from councils, board, and standing committees. And we will start with Faculty Advisory Council to the Illinois Board of Education, IBHE, and Linda will provide us with.
I actually have a question about the last proposed bylaw change. So we don't exclude chairs. Oh, I did not know that. Okay. Okay. Good afternoon. I'm going to report out today on the December FAC meeting, which was held at Prairie State College. Our January meeting last week, we were scheduled to convene at UIC and they were on strike. So we did not cancel our meeting. I know, good for them, right? We stood in solidarity with our colleagues and did not want to cross any picket lines. So we moved the meeting to the teachers, Chicago Teachers Union building, and actually had a great conversation with UPI President John Miller there. So I'll report out on that, what happened at that meeting in February. Yeah, because we had to move it within 2 days' time. It was quite interesting. So at Prairie State, we did have a presentation by the president, Michael Anthony, just to keep be mindful of your time. I'm not going to read my 13 pages of notes that are single spaced and probably 10 point font, right? Just kidding. Is anybody still awake? Are y'all doing okay? Okay. So he did discuss some of the post-pandemic challenges with Prairie State, including changing student needs, such as the course modality, decreasing enrollment, and something that many of us are facing, which is determining which programs are sustainable and which are not. It seems like he does involve faculty in these discussions and also takes into consideration what their area employers want. He said that, you know, they're looking at workforce development, and that's a big part of their conversation at Prairie State. The question was asked about, from the community college perspective, what do you want the four-year institutions to know or be thinking about? And he said, we're not really competing, we're partnering and adding value. The reasons are varied for students who choose to attend a community college or a two-year institution, such as like financial, sometimes they're place-bound, I'm not sure really what they want to do. And so they have to find a better way to partner with the four-year institution and then serve also the needs of those who are not looking to go into a four-year institution. Let's see, what else? And there was also a question about dual credit. It's a rather contentious subject on the FAC, in case you didn't notice. let's see, when it comes to talking about dual credit, he actually tried to avoid the question, I think. He said, I stay away from that. But anyway,
High school teacher taught dual credit courses can lead to reductions in staff at the community council, at the community colleges, and we know this. So it feels very competitive. But from a growth mindset, the more that's happening and taught, the better. He says, how do we engage students in new programs here? It is hard to do with a declining population of their high school students. So, and many faculty are concerned that they are outsourcing their classes to the high schools. So, let's see what else. We had a guest presentation. We had several, actually. I won't read them all, don't worry. From Rebecca Buckle on Prairie State's dental hygiene program. I have pages of notes on that. If you want more, I will just please let me know. Anybody interested in a dental hygiene program? I know, huh? And we had a guest presentation on Prairie State's African and African American Studies program. Great presentation too. Lots of notes. If you want to know anything about that, please email me. Jennifer Delaney, who's our rep on the IBHE, the faculty rep, again, shared her perspectives on the Illinois Commission on Equitable Public University Funding, which there's a the full commission meeting was on December 12th. She still remains concerned about the use of adequacy as a conceptual frame. And she said, we don't have a property tax base at public universities, which sometimes leads to creating artificial constructs to create buckets, and it moves us away from this data and it makes things definitely more complicated. She said the formula is becoming very convoluted and complicated. So this is concerning for setting up a statewide funding model. It is one step away from price controls because tuition is one of the few levers in economic downturns and when state funding is cut. Also, the model is about institutional costs, which fosters state level micromanagement. There are other ways of conceptualizing adequacy, such as, she said, looking at average funding for high school students and offering no less funding for higher ed. Very interesting, right? The president of Louisiana's higher ed system proposed an enrollment-based funding model with little performance-based funding if an institution was serving more vulnerable populations. And I think that's an important point to make. Those discussions will continue. And as we all know, Simone Weffer is the faculty rep on that commission, right? Let's see. I'm going to skip ahead. They're so quiet today. What's going on? What'd you do to them? We had Jackie Moreno from the Illinois Student Assistance Commission College Access Initiatives Managing Director. That's a really long title, isn't it? I wonder what her card must look like. Anyway, now Chief Service Officer, and we had Eduardo Brambilla from ESAC's Capacity Management Managing Director give us another talk. Great talk. They described programs that help first-generation students connect to college, such as the NEAR mentoring offered in each of Illinois community college districts through ISAC Corps, Illinois Gear Up for Middle School Students, the First Generation Scholars Network for students before and during their first year in college. And then she also described questions to prompt thoughtful course design and social capital building that faculty can develop with first generation students in mind. Great presentation if you want more information on that. Okay, let's skip ahead here. For our working group reports, yeah, we'll go here. Higher education funding, the working group is trying to discern its direction now that performance-based funding is by the wayside. They are preparing a short document listing items they think essential in any funding formula, like the institutional mission, equity, periodic review of items, et cetera. So they're going to revise their list. Equity Working Group is continuing to collect examples of university equity plans. I sent them ours. They have several. In fact, I sent them several websites. They're going to provide suggestions for improvement in the plans, and they are also collecting and curating resources for DEI. And they plan to present at the March IBHE meeting again. It's a very active group. Let's see here. The student faculty mental health working group, they have initial data from a trial survey with the FAC members. And they're trying to put together a PowerPoint summary for this group and potentially planning to pursue, they need IRB approval for a larger survey. Let's see, the early college online remote learning, they're working on a paper, I think. Yeah, description of potential benefits and costs of taking early college coursework and brought it to consideration to the FAC for consideration at the January meeting. We had a really robust discussion about that. prior learning assessment, rather than a position paper, they're preparing a short white paper aiming for a deadline of March and April. And student debt and affordability, we're floundering, but we're working, right? We met with Senator Laura Murphy, and legislators are waiting to resubmit the Aim High. The bills won't advance until there are answers about student loan forgiveness, so they're all just kind of waiting in flux there. Potential students today would be discouraged from student loan forgiveness, getting such a lukewarm reception from people, and this might affect us even more than it already has. We told Senator Murphy that we will try to synthesize our info and send it to her, because we did a little bit of research on programs in other states. And let's see, what else? Okay, for the private caucus, we talked about cybersecurity. Interesting, right? They had a presentation about that today here, yeah? Paul reported that in their experience at the privates, faculty aren't obligated to keep their scholarship only on university filing systems. The question of what is protected by FERPA and what is university property is a murky issue. What can I take with me if I move to another university? He said it's good to get some clarity. University lawyers tend to play it safe, so listen to them, but not too closely. Sorry. That was kind of funny. That's Paul. In general, our schools don't have written policies about these questions. That was his response. I don't know. Does NIU have any policies about these? I think I asked, and they said no. I asked the policy librarian, right? Community College reported that many of their schools have gone to two-factor authorization, but not all. Some have mandated cybersecurity training. Some have monthly trainings. Could you imagine? Using informative four-minute videos. Some schools require uploads to be done only on university systems. Some of us have contractual info that says when we develop materials for an online course, it is ours. For others, it becomes the property of the school. It's very complicated, isn't it? Don't ask these questions. For some, it can be shared from faculty member to faculty member. Some of us are required to back up everything on the drive our school uses. Others don't. Some faculty members are doing it or not, regardless. I'm sorry, I'm the only one amused today. I'm sorry. And let's see, the public caucus, Dan reported that data had been shared from RAMP. That's the Resource Allocation Management Program regarding the budget for each public university. And this data might be useful for questions such as how COVID money had been used, and it's available for everybody to view. And we talked about academic freedom issues with dual credit courses and whether or not they're going to be able to discuss certain issues with high school students in the classroom. It's a good point, right? Okay. And let's see, that concludes my report today. Our next meeting is going to be held virtually. Pat, if you need, knows how I feel about the Zoom meetings that are all day long. Yeah. Yeah, from 9 to 2:30 on Zoom. And in March, we're going to be at Chicago State. Any questions for me? Here for your entertainment, right?
Thank you very much. Okay, so we move to agenda item 11B, that is University Advisory Committee to the Board of Trustees. Members of this committee comprise of Felicia Bohannon, Polly Nicholson, Katie Jekyll, Karen Whitby, Brad Cribe, and myself. And I see that Felicia, Karen, and Holly are here. If any of you have any report or anything you would like to share, please feel free. But otherwise, I'm happy to kind of run through very kind of quick select highlights from the Board of Trustees meeting of December 8th, which was their last meeting. So agenda for this meeting revolve around few action items and informational presentations, but one of the highlight from that meeting for me was the huge presence of the United Faculty Alliance, UFA members at the Board of Trustees meeting. Due to the impasse between the union and the administration over the current and ongoing negotiations. Union President Dr. Kerry Ferris gave an impassionate presentation and asked the trustees to urge the administration to come back at the time to negotiation table. Fast forward till now, the impasse continued, and it is my sincere hope that progress will be made so that, you know, we can avert similar things. I think my colleague Linda just mentioned strike at UIC that nearly derailed the IBHE advisory council members meeting. So we hope that a progress will be made to this effect. Other main item of business was President Freeman's formal presentation of her 2023 university goals and her request of the trustees to approve these goals, which they did unanimously. The president, I want to say that she is very determined working with shared governance to implementing these goals, including many of which pertain to shared leadership, shared governance, and tenure and promotion review process that she's working very closely with the Faculty Senate Social Justice Committee. The president also requested the trustees' approval of three other action items, namely honorary doctorate recommendation for two candidates, one of whom whose name was forwarded for the Board of Trustees' approval, and that was Her Royal Highness Princess Gusti Kanjeng of Indonesia. And as I speak, I believe NIU has a robust academic kind of collaboration with academic institutions in Indonesia. The president also requested the board approval of appointment of Dr. Lori Ehrlich Piper as interim executive vice president and provost effective July 1st. And the board approved that request. Full reports and minutes of the Board of Trustees meetings can be accessed under agenda, under the informational item that you have in your packet. So with that, I will move to agenda item 11C and invite David Valentiner, Chair of Social Justice Committee, to provide any report he might wish.
Hi, I'm David Valentiner. I'm the chair of the Social Justice Committee. I wanted to thank those of you who responded to the question that we put out last meeting. I see that here on the agenda that the operating staff has a couple of questions that they're asking. I think that's a great practice. We had a question last time asking for concerns related to DEI issues, and some people responded. I just wanted to thank you for that. And I'm going to try to keep it short because we're running so late. Just a brief update on the activity, some of our activities. We have Shodan Hugh, who's leading the Academic Affairs Work Group, and they're in the process. They have over the next 4 to 6 weeks scheduled meetings in which they're taking their findings and recommendations regarding changes to tenure and promotion policies. They're taking that back to the colleges for to present those findings and recommendations and to stimulate more conversation. They're hoping to have to present some final recommendations at the end of this academic year, including perhaps some recommendations for the Faculty Senate. We're also the Institutional Racism Work Group has been working with the administration to try to create alignment between the presidential goals, particularly those related to DEI issues and the work of the Social Justice Committee. We have the sense that they're lifting up our recommendations and trying to use those recommendations as a way of bringing about some institutional change and change in policy. And there isn't really a great roadmap for doing that type of work. So there's some things that are straightforward, but there are some things that we're just figuring out as we go, including the way in which we try to work between Faculty Senate and the ADEI, the Academic Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Group, led by Dr. Vernice Edgehill-Walden, is rolling out the shared equity leadership model. And so we're trying to figure out what that is and get on board and support that. And I'll give more updates in the future. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Question for David.
Cynthia Campbell, Department of Educational Technology, Research and Assessment. So how many people responded to about the DEI issues?
I think I got two emails with information. There may be a third, but I think that a lot of the information that we got was people wanted to give it anonymously through their faculty senators. And one of the comments was a request for creating a mechanism for anonymous input, which we're in the process of discussing. I have some reservations about anonymous surveys because of the lack of accountability and the, you know, there's all sorts of complexities associated with it. But I do think that we should try to create at least some mechanism by which people can express their views with some sense of safety, with some confidentiality. And so we're trying to, that's one of the topics that we're taking up of how to move that forward. Was there a particular thought that you had?
Yeah, I was thinking about to sort of cast a wider net if there could be some way to, like you just said, send out some sort, create and send out some sort of survey so people would feel safe, you know, to respond candidly.
Yeah.
And also for thinking about those who may be untenured, feeling a little bit apprehensive about sharing whatever their perspective is, being new in fear of retribution or consequences.
Yeah. That is certainly echoes one of the suggestions that we did get and that we're currently considering. And so maybe at the next Faculty Senate Social Justice Committee meeting, we may make some progress on that. But yeah, so one possibility is to have it somehow proctored by a third party who would then preserve the confidentiality and de-identify things to bring forward those concerns. One of the problems with anonymous portals or comment boxes is that, you know, it could be a mechanism of harassment. It could be a mechanism of saying bad things about certain people. It could be a mechanism of making threats. You know, there's no accountability when it's totally anonymous. So I like the idea of having some confidentiality in there.
So, thank you.
Yep.
Got a question for David? Great. Thank you. We move to agenda item 11D, Student Government Association. I know Dallas was here, and I guess. Operating staff, council report. I don't see Polly also is not here. She was here, but she left, and Natasha is also not here. But they did provide questions that you know, you should feel free if you like to reach out and send them your thought. So this brings us to item 11F, and that is support to professional staff council. This year is here, and floor is yours.
We are celebrating our 10th year of offering the support of professional staff dependent scholarship. We were able to this year to increase the one scholarship that we offer to either a child or a grandchild of an SPSS employee, increase that amount from $1,000 to $1,250. And then starting last year, we were able to begin offering a second award, which is offered to a student who has been significantly positively impacted by an SPSS employee. And so we were able to increase that amount from $500 to $750. And that scholarship, the due date has been extended to February 28th, and we are also moving forward with a campaign to endow that scholarship. So we would diligently be reaching out to increase funds over the coming years. But we're just very excited about being able to increase those amounts this year. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Felicia? Okay, so this takes us to agenda item 12, informational items that are indeed informational, as the title suggests. You could always visit this, including some of the presentation we had today, Baccalaureate Council, Academic Planning Council, Board of Trustees, and the like. There are minutes and can always be accessed here. With that, we come to the last agenda item, and that is adjournment. And with that, I would like to entertain a motion to adjourn today's meeting. Okay, a second. All in favor, say aye. Great, thank you very much, Chair.
Linda?